Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca. Last month, at Astoria City Hall, the Lower Columbia Diversity Project sponsored a public discussion of sexual assault. On today's program, we'll offer excerpts from that two-hour discussion, exploring the extent of the crime, the devastation faced by victims, and the help that's available. The speakers were Susie Wilkins and Sharon Beatty of the Clatsop County Women's Resource Center, Chief Deputy District Attorney Ron Brown, and clinical therapist Linda Rocky of Coast Rehabilitation Services. Many assault victims don't report the crime. The reasons, as Beatty explains, include re-traumatization and victim blaming.
Women hear it a lot. Your skirt is too short. No wonder you got raped. You walked through a dangerous neighborhood. What did you expect? You talk about your sex life openly. No wonder people touch you without consent. You blog about being bisexual. No wonder men don't respect you. You're openly lesbian. No wonder you can't get certain jobs. And you've outed yourself as a trans on a website. No wonder you're discriminated against. So these are a lot of the things that victims hear when they do come forward. I don't find that law enforcement is making these comments. I find that it's their friends, their family, their coworkers, the people who are closest to them actually make these comments about them.
And I frankly found probably every week we have problems with victims' families because most people would like to think that it doesn't happen in our family because it's a horrible thing. It's like having a major illness or it's like having a real bad car accident. All of a sudden it's dumped into your family. So you'd like to think it doesn't happen at all. But just like if you knew somebody that had a serious medical problem or was in a car wreck, you'd do something about it. And we really need to educate primarily our older people in our families about it does happen. It happens across the board. It happens in every type of household, no matter what your socioeconomic level is, whatever your race is, whatever your sexual persuasion is, it happens everywhere. I frankly think with the younger generation, I'd rather have a jury full of 18-year-olds because they get it as far as sexual abuse way, way better than older people do because it's something that has only become conversational in the last 20 years or so, or maybe not even that. So I think one of the primary components is educating families that it happens everywhere and you got to deal with it. You can't just scoop it under the rug.
So a working definition of victim blaming, right? Because we are going to spend some time on this because this is a huge part of the reality of SA survivors, okay? The best working definition I have found of it so far is when victims are explicitly or implicitly blamed for their own assault. Now just take a minute and think about how you feel about that. Someone comes up, you get mugged, and someone looks at you and says, well, why did you let that happen? And this wrongfully shifts the burden of prevention from the perpetrator onto the victim. I did a training in October, and one of the best questions I heard during that whole training was this one. What is a rapeable offense? Think about that for a minute. What is a rapeable offense? What can someone do that is so bad and so wrong to deserve that happening to them? That really puts it in perspective. And it really shifts the blame off of the victim to the perpetrator. Because who ultimately is responsible for sexual assault? With the victim blaming comes shame, comes guilt, comes obviously blame, the low self-esteem that you were talking about, the not talking about it in the families. You know, I mean, there's this whole wealth of reactions that come along with it, and all of that responsibility gets put on the survivor.
And they get called liars, just flat out.
Yeah.
Just flat, she's lying, she's making it up.
Yeah. Yeah. And is it 2%? No, I can't remember.
3%. The false rate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
There's 3% of the reports that are made are false reports. And I have another stat that says 97% of rapists will walk free. 97%. So it makes it very difficult for people to come forward. That is such a large number. 3% are false reports, 97% are walking free.
Another aspect of it is fear of retaliation. Fear of retaliation, the perpetrator retaliating. If this was somebody in their family and they come forward, there can be some really hardcore retaliation, starting with, you know, I mean, you can be disowned, which is hardcore, but if there's also physical violence involved in it, that can increase if you come forward, all right? Families can retaliate. I mean, if someone comes forward and says, you know, grandpa or grandma was doing this to me, the family can rally around the perpetrator and reject the survivor. And that can get really, really vicious, really painful. And not only have you lost your self-esteem, your sense of safety, your place in the community, you just lost your family. Friends, and then society, you know, and I'm going to keep bringing it back to society, to our community. We are a huge part of all of these dynamics, whether we are fully aware of it or not. You know, but when society starts attacking you, with you saying, you know, they're all liars and sluts, you know, if a man is sexually assaulted, then all of a sudden, excuse my language, he's a faggot and a queer, okay? Why are you going to come forward when these are being directed at you, you know? And so it's up to us to try and open a space. If someone comes to you and says, this happened, open up a space in your world to go, okay, let's talk. Very few people come forward and lie about this because it's one of the hardest things to say. You've got one of the biggest stigmas connected to it. It is really hard to live with.
And most of the lies, they're just like when your kids lie to you. It's usually pretty easy to figure out who's lying and who's not when you get into the details, because that's when things usually go off the tracks. And so usually we don't get cases that go very far where the lying kids are not figured out. So
poor adults. When it comes to healing trauma, there are three stages that Judith Herman came up with some years ago. And the first one, I think I'm paraphrasing the first one, so if you go look it up, don't hold me to this exact thing. But the first one is storytelling. We need to be able to tell our stories. And in that telling of our stories, and I don't mean make-believe stories or any of that, I mean the real story, the reality of it, what happened, how it felt, you know, what we've gone through. And part of that is having someone who actually listens to what is being said and can share that experience with the other person. And in that sharing comes validation, all right? Even if you don't believe every single detail being said, believe the story, all right? When people are traumatized, the memory storage, the way our brains work, it becomes fragmented. I'm simplifying a very complex reality here with the brain. But we can, normally we'll remember sequentially, all right? A, B, C, D happened, and then E followed, all right? When we go through a traumatic experience, it goes A, E, D, Z. And when we tell the story, that's how we tell it, okay? We don't tell it sequentially. So when you're listening to someone, and this is how they're telling the story, it can come across as crazy, it can come across as lying, all right? Those are the two main things I've seen people react, you know, with the two words they use the most, right? Because to us, unless you know the language of trauma, it's not making sense. But they really are telling you the truth. We don't remember it sequentially, all right? We bop around in it in our heads. And that's how we tell the story, until we can tell it enough times that we can put those pieces back together. Then we can tell it sequentially. So it takes a lot of patience, a lot of love, and a lot of time to listen to those stories. And it's essential. It's the first step in the healing process. You know, and I can tell you from my personal experience as an SA survivor, the first time someone looked at me and said, I believe you, my whole world changed. Just that alone made it that my heart could start opening and start healing, you know. The second stage is grieving and mourning. We are going to grieve what was lost, what was stolen, what was taken from us.
Susie, can I say one thing about reporting?
Yes.
Before you go on to that. Reporting is also a gradual thing. Oftentimes people remember more and more and report more and more as they go. So the first or second time they tell the story, they're probably not going to cover every detail or every incident or every number of times or maybe even all the perpetrators that have abused them. So that can be kind of perplexing too as to how that all fits together. But it's because it's coming out in portions.
So the grieving in the morning is just that. We're grieving what was lost, we're grieving what was stolen, we're grieving what we never had. You know, children who were assaulted, never had a childhood. That's a lot to grieve when you're grown and you realize this was taken away from me for no good reason. You know?
We also lose trust in our own validation.
Yeah.
because you begin to believe I trusted that person, so something's wrong with me, my picker's broken is what they call it. So you lose that validation belief and your picker's broken, yeah. You know, so it's just another loss.
And so we do have to mourn it. We do have to grieve it. It's part of the healing process, you know, and it can go in cycles. It can go back and forth. It's not, again, this isn't a, you know, it's not going to happen in 2 months when you're okay. It can be ongoing, but as long as the grieving is happening, there's healing happening. And then the last stage is reintegration. And it's reintegration into your society, into your community, and into yourself. All right, so you take all those pieces, those fragmented pieces, and you do the healing work and you put them together, and the people around you help you do it, because we can't do this alone. I mean, one of my favorite things to say, I suppose that's the wrong way to say it, but anyway, one of my favorite things to say is rape happens in isolation. All right, someone does not come riding in on a white horse to save you, or else you wouldn't have got it, just wouldn't have happened. Someone would have saved you. But we heal outside of isolation. We heal in community. We heal in the micro community and the macro community. You know, like I said, the first person who sat there and said, I believe you, that was the beginning of the healing. That was the end of the isolation, the end of the secret keeping. And the reintegration, okay? And that's a huge part, because we've taken all those fragmented pieces and put them back together, and now we're, I'm not gonna say a new person, I'm not gonna say a better person. We're different, and we're stronger, and we are on that healing journey, where there's a lot of power in that healing journey, and it takes a lot of people to do it. So I asked you, you know, when you think of the victim or the survivor, what do you visualize? You know, so the same question is, when you think of a perpetrator, what do you visualize? You know, but we have a nice stereotype based TV. You know, that they're going to be these big, burly, scary, snaggle-toothed, ugly, wild-haired men coming at us, you know, or big, muscle-bound men coming at us. And they're going to jump out of bushes or drag us into alleyways. Stereotypes, all right? And I'm sure you can speak on this, Ron. Perpetrators come in all shapes and forms.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, all shapes and forms. And a good portion of them are very socially adept. I think that's the best word to use. You know, charming, articulate, can blend in well in a crowd, do not draw attention to themselves. Because if you're the perpetrator, you don't want to get caught. Why would you draw attention to yourself?
You know? I'm going to tell you that they interviewed 100 rapists, and they asked them, what's the first thing you look for in a victim? Believe it or not, the first thing they looked for, and these are adult victims, was a ponytail. That was the first thing they looked for. Of course, they looked for women alone and, you know, other things like that. But the first answer was a ponytail, because they said if her hair is up and you grab her whole head, she has to follow. If her hair is down and you grab part of the hair, she might rip that hair out to get away. That was the number one thing that these 100 rapists said that they looked for.
Part of the survival is knowing what the tactics are, knowing what behaviors to look for, all right? Because no one comes with a stamp on their head.
I'm just wondering, with somebody who would rape, they have to be lacking an empathy gene,
yes,
or something. I mean, they have to be a sociopathic kind of person.
There has to be a sickness.
Very charming and everything else,
yeah,
but there's something missing that would enable them to do that to another person.
There has to be a sickness and a sense of entitlement. They
control
feel,
and power.
Yep, control, yeah, and power, because that's what rape really is. It's power and control issues.
And
that, yeah, leads to entitlement. If they feel entitled and they have that sickness, they may act on it.
But what you're speaking to is just how pronounced the sickness is that the person has, but you can't tell by looking at them.
Right.
That's the problem.
Right.
But it's so pronounced that that's why something, you know, significant has to happen in that person's life, or you have to take them out of circulation one way or the other.
Three tactics. Accessibility has to be present. Vulnerability has to be present. And lack of credibility has to be present. So when someone is looking for a victim, they're actually looking for these three things. Accessibility, can I get to that person? Vulnerability. Is this person going to be a good prey or not, right? Because a lot of assailants see themselves as hunters, as far as I can tell. So, you know, is this going to be someone who doesn't fight back or can't fight back as easily, all right? And then the lack of credibility. You know, it's really easy to call somebody a liar if they're developmentally delayed and cannot speak the way that we're used to somebody speaking. One of the big things that we see a lot, hear a lot about, is intoxication.
I probably review reports practically every week, at least every month, where someone's gotten drunk and gone home with someone, or went out on a date with somebody, it doesn't necessarily have to be a pickup, and ends up not remembering what happened or thinking they were, you know, and it's really difficult to sort out. So it's very common.
It is. It's extremely common. And when somebody is intoxicated, they're more vulnerable. Okay? If you're high, if you're drunk, if you're loaded, all right, and no judgments, trust me, no judgments, you can't necessarily fight back as much. You can't necessarily verbalize yourself as much. Sometimes you're so incapacitated, you're not even awake. How are you supposed to protect yourself or even try to protect yourself in those situations?
Anytime that a person is not consenting to a sexual act, then it's a crime, no matter what age the perpetrator is and what age the victim is, and regardless of whether they have any prior sexual history, boyfriend, girlfriend, or significant other, or whatever the thing is, it becomes rape or some kind of forcible crime if any degree of force is used. It doesn't have to be holding a knife to somebody's throat, it doesn't have to be strangling somebody, it doesn't have to be a gun to somebody's head. It just has to be the use of some degree of physical force to get your way. And coercion, on the other hand, is when you use some sort of leverage to get your way with the person by, oh, you know that there are some pictures that were taken in Playboy magazine or something of the victim, or you know of some dirt on the person that you will make known to everybody if they don't have sexual relations with you. So that's how it all factors in, and they all pretty much amount to the same thing. Of usually lack of consent is a little bit less serious crime if you have sexual contact or sexual intercourse with somebody without consent versus using physical force. That is a little bit more severe generally, but there are all various ways of committing a crime.
Yeah.
The poem, the title is called 189. And it says, experts say that the average woman does 189 things a day to prevent being assaulted or raped. What would a woman do? Hold her keys in her hand, one key protruding between her knuckles just in case she needs a weapon. Pepper spray on her keychain and a personal alarm in her purse. Never walk alone at night. Never walk in an unknown area alone day or night. Before getting in, look under the car and in the back seat. Cross to the other side of the street when a man is coming towards her. Never, never make eye contact. Or did they say always, always make eye contact? Take self-defense class and assertiveness training. Lock the car doors, roll up the windows, lock the front and back door. Never set your drink down in a bar or a party. Never accept a drink from a stranger. And of course, she should never flirt or get drunk. Because if she does and he rapes her, she was asking for it and she wanted it. How can we expect him to stop himself? How many more things seem as normal as waking up or brushing our teeth, experts say? A man who does 189 things a day to prevent sexual assault would be diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. But not a woman. She's being smart. She's doing what she's supposed to do. I'm tired. I'm tired of holding the responsibility in the way I dress and where I walk. I'm tired of holding the responsibility just because I am a woman. And that's just the way it goes. 189 things a day, 68,985 things a year, so that I can stop the rapist from raping me. So why don't we start the one who holds the power, the one who wants the power? Why not teach all of us it is wrong to control, to hurt, or to dominate? So why don't we give him a list of 189 things to do each day to prevent rape? Avoid using sexist language. Listen to women. Stop when she says stop. Volunteer with children. Stop staring at our breasts and slapping our bottoms, because we're on the radio. Learn about feminism, masculinity, and love. And again, we do realize it is not gender specific, but thank you for allowing me to share that poem.
In Astoria, we're blessed to have the Lighthouse, which is a child abuse assessment center, where we take kids, usually anybody anybody that's under 14 or under that's made some disclosure of sexual abuse. And we have trained evaluators, first of all, a physician who actually goes over them from head to toe to see if there's anything physically wrong with them, or if they just simply have any kind of dental problems or head lice, you name it. They see just about everything there. And then they transfer over to a videotaped interview where a qualified person that's trained by CARES over in Portland interviews them about any kind of sexual abuse and then fleshes it all out. And then generally then the doctor and the interviewer get together and come up, was this kid sexually abused or was this kid not? It can either be, no, we don't think so, yes, they were, or there's a lot of concerning behavior, but we don't know yet because the kid's only 3 or the kid's only 4 and not very conversant, that sort of thing. And doctors are allowed to give, sexual abuse is a medical diagnosis that's accepted by the American Medical Association. But the Oregon Supreme Court, about 2 years ago, said that medical diagnosis of sexual abuse was too subjective by a physician, that it was only based upon the doctors looking at the person and just based on the subjective belief or disbelief of the individual. Therefore, the opinion is not admissible without physical findings. The exasperating thing was that 180 degree changed the law. We were able to get doctors to come in all the time before that to give their opinions. And frankly, their opinions were just that, because the defense attorneys would bring out that it wasn't based on an x-ray or a blood test or anything else, but the doctors would always point out, but we do those kind of things every day of the week, so this is just part of the trade. The really exasperating thing is we got to retry all the cases that went to trial prior to that Southard opinion being, or at the time of the Southard opinion being decided. So we've already had 3 or 4 different cases locally that were reversed. And it was really exasperating because the Oregon Supreme Court sat on it for 18 months. From the time that the lawyers presented all their arguments, they sat on it for 18 months before they rendered a decision. Now, guess how many cases got tried in 18 months in our state that didn't need to be tried or could have been tried a little differently with 2 or 3 questions less? Because frankly, I think it was just one of the most screwy decisions I've ever seen. Because doctors give opinions in all kinds of criminal cases, when you've got a slip and fall, when you've got a medical malpractice case, they give opinions all the time. They aren't necessarily supported by documentary evidence. So, anyway, we're kind of at a loss right now with our appellate courts because they all seem very slanted for the defendant.
The sexual assault dynamics are psychological and physical reactions. So. Emotional, psychological, shock, disbelief, disorientation, and detachment, confusion, bewilderment, collectedness, and calmness. No two victims are going to act the same. They're just not going to act the same. I've been at sexual assaults at the hospital. I've got victims that laugh during sexual assault. I have victims that cry. I have victims that get into fetal position. I have victims that are just like, okay, do what you need to do. They're just very calm about it. Mm-hmm. Very, very matter of a fact. Something else I've noticed is I'm working with a family. This is a third generation. I worked with the grandma, I worked with the mother, and now I'm working with the daughter. And I could be wrong, but I have a belief system that until you begin to heal, you can't protect the next generation. That, and again, I could be very, very wrong, but it is my experience of 17 years. If you go out and eat a bad piece of fish, 2 girlfriends run to the bathroom, they hold their hair back, and one gets sick, and you get the sickness out. If you get raped or sexually assaulted, you tend to swallow it down. You don't want to talk about it. You don't want to, my favorite words, puke it up. So you never pull your hair back. No one ever helps you, you know. If you can't bring up your own stuff and then it happens to your family, how can you be there to support them? Because it re-triggers your stuff. And so I have found, now that I'm working with three generations deep, grandma didn't heal. Grandma tried, couldn't do it. Mom tried, couldn't do it. And now we're into this young 14-year-old teenage daughter, 15-year-old daughter, who it's now happened to, and they can't support her right. So I'm thankful she's now coming into the office and hopefully can get the support and hopefully one day it decides to prosecute. You know, that's our goal. The other dynamics are embarrassment, shame, denial, sadness, grief, and numbness. So yes. Again,
something I wanted to say about shame, I think I actually heard this on TED Talk. box. So it's, and it's the best description I've heard of shame, blame, and guilt. Guilt is, I made a mistake. Blame is, you are a mistake. And shame is, I am a mistake.
That is the number one thing that victims bring to me. I made a mistake. This is my fault. I shouldn't have looked like that, dressed like that, smelled like that. Somehow I have done something wrong. So another one of the dynamics is depression and guilt due to the shame.
Yep.
Another is going to be anger and powerlessness. Sometimes they get very, very angry, but it's from the lack of powerlessness that they felt to be able to protect themselves at the time.
And the injustice.
And the injustice, absolutely.
Yeah, betrayal.
So they can have dulled senses. Something can make a big loud bang and they're kind of just calm about it. Other clients, something bangs and they jump right out of their skin. I have to go collect them from across the street and bring them back in is what it feels like, because they just jumped right out of the building, you know? Fear and anxiety. They have distrust, self-imposed restrictions on life and activities, short-term memory loss, and hypervigilance. Those happen in our victims. We see them over and over. And one of my favorite sayings is, you can only go as fast as the slowest part of you feels safe to go. That's what healing is. You can't rush a client, a survivor, through healing. They can only go as fast as the slowest part of them feels safe to go. It takes years sometimes. It's going to go back to the self-care. To keep that victim willing to become a survivor and go forward with it, he or she's really got to practice that self-care. You got to do it in little tiny bits. So if you're over talking to the district attorney and he needs an hour of your time, give him that hour, then go out and go for a walk along the river, or my favorite, eat some chocolate, then come back to it. One of the things I teach is the Courage to Heal workbook. And again, we do it in little 1 hour spots. And then for a week, I don't encourage them to come back in for a week. Take that 6 days, go do something else. Then come back in and we're going to have our hard day. So that's my...
The victim really needs a support system too. Mm-hmm. You've got to have a support system from day one until day whatever. And also the support system should involve some people, some official people, as well as friends and family members, a little of everybody, clergy if there's anybody like that involved. But it's going to be for the long haul. And then we always impress on the victim that they don't have to talk about it with anybody if they don't want to.
There's an incredible book out there. Okay. I use the Courage to Heal workbook for my victims. There's one that's set up for men by the same
Ellen Bass.
Yep, that's the author that wrote it. Yep. And it is incredible. It helps the husbands, the fiancés, the boyfriends, or if it was a wife, or you know, it helps you to understand that there's gonna be good days and bad days. Like I said, most of the time it takes a lifetime to heal. And we as survivors, we want to be over it. It just keeps rearing its little head. Romantic relationships are some of the hardest. My experience has been, we tend to pull you in real close, and then it gets scary, and we push you away a little bit. And then we pull you in, and then it's too scary, and we push you away a little bit. So it's learning to work with that.
The 24-hour crisis line at the Women's Resource Center is 503-325-5735. To find out about volunteering or to donate to the Women's Resource Center, call 503-325-4962. And that's the Human Beat for this month. It was recorded by Coast Radio engineer Terry Wilson. Thanks for listening. I'm Roger Rocca.